Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Brookfield Property Partners section of the agenda. My name is Brian Kingston. I'm the CEO of the business. I'm going to start things off with a bit of an overview of our business, and I'll be joined on stage by some of my colleagues who'll go through a bit more of a detailed overview of each of our businesses. And they're all seated here in the front row. I'll maybe just quickly introduce them. Rick Clark, who's my partner in overseeing the real estate business and the chairman of BPY. Next to him is Brian Davis, our CFO. Ashley Lawrence, who's our head of retail asset management, and Lowell Barron, who looks after our multifamily rental apartments business. So once we run through, I guess, an overview of the business, Brian's going to try and tie it all together, talk a bit about our balance sheet, our outlook for earnings over the next couple of years, and then, you know, we'd be happy to take any questions that you may have from the audience. We'll try and save about a half an hour at the end for that. So starting with our business. You know, really just as a bit of an overview, Brookfield Property Partners, or BPY, is Brookfield's primary vehicle for investing in real estate. And we really invest across all of the various strategies. Core and core plus assets, which are typically very long life, stable cash flow generating assets, we generally invest in directly on our balance sheet. But you know, what's a little unique about our business is that we also do have an investment through our participation in some of Brookfield's private equity funds. And for those of you who've been here over the last couple of days, you'll understand how that additional capital investing alongside of our balance sheet can be really beneficial in terms of the access to larger transactions that we may not want to put entirely on our balance sheet gives us. And so, you know, we think it's really a unique structure. You know, the core plus assets provide good, predictable long-term cash flows and a lot of upside through the more opportunistic side of investing. You know, we think generates superior returns to just simply buy and hold. Our goal is simple and you know, really unchanged. It's to be the leading owner and operator of real estate assets and generate good long-term returns for our shareholders through a combination of a stable and growing cash flow yield, as well as a compounding annual appreciation in the value of our assets. You know, really the way the balance sheet breaks down is we have about 80% of our capital today that's invested in these core investments, properties like the one that we're in today, Brookfield Place, New York, Canary Wharf in London, Ala Moana Shopping Center in Honolulu, et cetera. And, you know, these highly sought after assets generally produce returns of 10 to 12% over very long periods of time. The other 20% of our balance sheet is invested in what we describe as opportunistic investments. And this doesn't mean lower quality or higher risk. In fact, many of the assets that we're investing in through the strategy would be very at home in our core operating platforms. It refers more to the shorter term duration of the business plan. And oftentimes these investments have a much larger component of operational turnaround to them. The reward for being able to move quickly, take risks where maybe others are afraid to do that, is much higher returns. And we're generally earning 20% plus returns on these types of investments. You know, for those of you who have been following us over the years, none of this is new. This is how we've been investing in real estate and in fact, all of our businesses, including infrastructure and power, for a very long period of time. We're value investors, able to move quickly and decisively on large, multifaceted transactions, often investing in sectors or geographies at times when capital is scarce and there's less capital competing for these high-quality assets. And once we've acquired the assets, we utilize our operating platforms to enhance the performance, to drive returns out of them. And once those improvements have been made, we're very active in recycling our balance sheet and taking that capital out of those stabilized properties, and putting them back into higher returning investment strategies. And you know, while this is, you know, this has been a long-term strategy, the Brookfield Property Partners, you know, really was just spun out of Brookfield Asset Management about 3 years ago. But over that period of time, we have undergone a significant amount of change in the business. Starting with the $5 billion privatization of Brookfield office properties, which really converted what was a substantial holding in another public company to a direct ownership of 149 of the best office buildings in the world in all the major markets around that we like to invest in. We've consolidated our ownership in General Growth Properties and in Canary Wharf, increasing our interest in both of those businesses. And we've put about $3 billion of capital to work in our opportunistic strategies. And we'll talk a bit more about some of those investments later on. To fund all of this growth and these new investments, we've issued about $6 billion of equity and recycled a further $5 billion out of our more mature assets. This was a snapshot of where we were in 2013 at the time we spun the business out. And this is an overlay for where we are today. Really what it shows is we've had substantial growth in some of the markets that we were previously in, including the US and the UK and Europe, but we've also made inroads into some new markets, including China, India, and more recently, the Middle East. In addition to going into new geographies, we've also expanded the business into a number of new sectors, including logistics, hotels, self-storage, manufactured housing, and more recently, student housing. And you know, really, as a result of that, we have we think we have a very unique business here in terms of its diversity and the quality of the assets that we own. So it's it's 100 million square feet of office with a further 10 million square feet that's currently under development. We own 128 of the best malls in the United States, 35,000 apartments, 54 million square feet of modern logistics facilities, and a development capability to go along with that. Nearly 20,000 hotel rooms, as I say, a number of other new sectors that we've been investing in, like self-storage and student housing. As a result of that, the business has grown pretty substantially from where we started, nearly doubling our asset base, the earnings have grown along with the increase in the value of the business. You'll see these couple of themes really coming through as we run through each of our businesses on an overall basis. We've really been focused on four things over the past 12 months, and we'll continue to be focused on the same four things in the year ahead. Number one is just continuing to enhance the flexibility of our balance sheet, refinancing, terming out, reducing the cost on our corporate facilities. Recycling capital out of these mature assets where, we've created a bond-like instrument and we can sell them into a very strong market in most of the places that we are today, and then take that capital and reinvest it. Year to date, we've done about $1.5 billion of net equity, expect to have about $2 billion done this year, and really use of the proceeds was to reduce our corporate leverage, to fund these new investments, to fund our new developments, and buy back our shares, which we'll come to in a second. On the operations side, it's just a relentless focus on driving occupancy and driving performance out of our assets, and that includes improving the occupancy on the on our existing properties, but also leasing up our new developments, that 10 million square feet that's currently under construction. The other major priority that we've had over the past year is putting some efforts into getting a share price and a trading price on our shares that better reflects what we see as the underlying value of the real estate that we own. To do that, we've been very active in our outreach to the investor and analyst community, spending a lot of time making sure that people understand the story, that it's well understood. We've spent time and effort attempting to get inclusion in some of the major indexes that a lot of our investors use to benchmark their own performance. One of the major roadblocks to that seems to be the structure as a publicly traded partnership, which we think comes with a lot of benefits, is somewhat limiting in index inclusion. And so we're actively exploring the idea of converting the business to a REIT, a U.S. REIT, which obviously would potentially make us eligible for inclusion in indexes and, again, have us appeal to a much broader universe of investors. And as I mentioned, if the shares do continue to trade at a discount, we have an ability to surface capital from our more mature assets and utilize that cash to buy back our stock if we think that's the best use of that capital. So those are really the priorities. We often get asked, particularly on the last one, why do we think that the shares trade at a discount to what we continually say is the underlying value of the real estate. For those of you who have been here for the last couple of days, you'll know that we've been working polling questions into to some of the presentations. So we thought with a room full of some of the most sophisticated investors in the world, we might actually turn that around and ask all of you why you think our stock trades at such a discount. So this, in a second, will should push a question out to those of you who have an iPad as opposed to multiple choice. What we'd like you to do is just maybe provide a word that you think describes the one word. In fact, if you try two, I think you only get the first. Describes what you think is driving it, and you know, we'll maybe give that a second just to see. But yeah, so look at, you know, I think the themes that are coming through are pretty common. You know, as I mentioned earlier on the structure, we think that there's really two elements to it. But, you know, clearly having a publicly traded partnership limits some of the investors. On the complexity, I think, you know, we've been making a lot of efforts over the past year to try and explain, you know, why we think, although there is a lot of assets and it's a lot of different sectors and geographies that we're in, the business is not really that complex. At the end of the day, we collect rent, we pay our interest, and we distribute what's left over to you. But obviously, there's a little more to the business. So, you know, look, we appreciate all of your input. Brian and I are going to, that looks like a lot of homework for Brian and I, but we'll try and take some of that away and see if there's more that we can be doing. So with that, we'll turn back to the presentation, and Rick Clark's going to take us through our office platform in a bit more detail.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Brian. So I'm really happy to be here today to just give you an update on what's going on within our office business. And you know, I'd start by saying this business has been honed over a very long period of time. It was one of our initial businesses. It's central to everything that we do in real estate and provides Brookfield Property Partners with a foundation for stable, predictable cash flow in our coming out of our core office portfolio. Within this platform, we own some of the most recognizable, iconic, irreplaceable assets in the most dynamic and resilient markets around the world. We've been in this business, as I said, for a very long period of time. And over the years, we spent a lot of time building relationships with the world's largest consumers of office space. We've really made it our business to understand how the employees driving these businesses and the world's economy at that, how they work. At the end of the day, these companies want to locate in an environment that helps them attract, retain, and motivate top talent. The competition for these folks is fierce, and at the end of the day, work environment often makes a difference in attracting them. Of course, we're in the business of making money in the real estate business, so we own a very diverse group of properties. But within the core office group, the focus is on owning great properties that are not only well-located, that are highly efficient, of the highest technical quality, and inclusive of top-notch amenities. The age cohort moving the world's economy works differently. Work-life play balance is important, and they want to be able to move from one to the other immediately. Hence, they live where they work, near where they work, they play near where they work, and they want access to efficient transportation when they need to move around. From this knowledge comes our focus in investing in mixed-use properties that help employers achieve their principal goal. Our premium offering in this regard are large scale and mixed use. We refer to these as Brookfield Place, like this complex we're in today. Our focus on buying, redeveloping, and building projects like Brookfield Place in New York or Canary Wharf or Potsdamer Platz in Berlin is really a differentiator for us. As of today, we own 7 of these complexes that would fit our very stringent Brookfield Place criteria, and are underway at the beginning of developing another one. We're also studying redeveloping 2 of our projects into Brookfield Places and are actively working on acquiring another one right now. So in total, if all of what we're working on comes to fruition, these great iconic properties that you would recognize around the world that are currently 7 could grow to 11. Something that's very core to our core office portfolio. Overseeing and complementing our properties in the office operating platform is an operating platform that is highly experienced, has full service capabilities, is able to do anything within the business, and a white glove mentality. Brookfield has made meaningful investments in operating platforms, including the core office one, for several reasons. For one, so that if a tenant's leasing space from us in New York or Toronto or London or anywhere, they know what to expect, which is a consistent top level of experience. This garners repeat business, which is incredibly valuable for us. In fact, of our top 20 office tenants, more than 75% are in more than one city with us, and more than 50% are in three or more cities. Secondly, the experience contained within this platform gives us the ability to underwrite assets and markets with a high degree of confidence that we really understand the opportunity, we understand the challenges, we know the risks, and we know how to put things in place to de-risk our exposure to these investments. We have $15 billion of our capital invested in the core office sector, with 1,600 of our 14,000 real estate employees around the world looking after it. Our core business, as Brian mentioned, covers 149 properties, 101 million square feet, in 18 cities in six countries. Our portfolio, with an overall 92% occupancy, has further room to grow as we work to achieve an achievable run rate goal of 95%. With a long-term average lease life of 8.3 years in a geographically diversified portfolio that attracts the highest credit quality tenants, our core office business, as you see from this slide, produces steady, stable, and growing income. 50% of our portfolio is located within the U.S., with the majority of the balance pretty evenly balanced between Canada, Australia, and the U.K. In each of these four countries, we are either the largest office landlord or among the largest, giving us a scale in each to be relevant and to perform extremely well. Recent successes in the redevelopment and transformation of the World Financial Center into Brookfield Place, New York, new leases coming online at this complex and elsewhere within our portfolio are driving meaningful same property NOI growth. Fiscal year 2016, same property NOI, excluding foreign exchange, is trending towards about $1.35 billion and a projected 11 to 12% increase over the prior year. So, notwithstanding many years of strength and growth in this real estate economic cycle, demand to invest in high quality office assets in gateway cities have not abated in the least. We are certainly conscious of this, and also conscious that some of our office properties have been worked to a stabilized level of performance without a lot of room for meaningful mid or long-term growth. These types of assets have a low risk profile, which appeals to the core institutional investor willing to put money to work at nominal but safe returns. Recognizing this, a few years ago, we set out on a multi-year asset sale program, and we're on track to raise $2 billion of equity from recycling capital out of our core office assets in this year. We're aiming to execute a few further asset sales over the next 6 to 12 months, including selling interest in properties in New York and London, after which our core office portfolio will largely normalize to a certain extent going forward. The assets or interest in assets monetized this year, as you can see from this chart, were traded at an average going-in cap rate of 4.2%, considerably below the implied cap rate of where our units are trading today. Proceeds, as Brian mentioned earlier, have been reinvested in purchasing our units in accretive acquisitions and developments or in other higher yielding opportunities. Now, the next few slides here cover some of our investment activities and how we're putting some of this recycled capital to work. We thought that it would be useful to take a minute to review an investment that we made late last year, the beginning of this year, which we're particularly excited about. More specifically, at the beginning of the year, we acquired Berlin's Potsdamer Platz complex, which is an iconic collection of properties that were built in the 1980s, right at where the Berlin Wall sort of turned corners, right after the wall came down. As I mentioned, our considerable investment in platforms gives us a somewhat unique ability to use our in-house teams to underwrite assets, markets, overall opportunities with a lot of confidence. In this case, we pulled together folks from our office, multifamily, hotel, and retail teams to understand this potential investment in this iconic property. What our diligence discovered is that we had a motivated seller working under a mandatory liquidation of a maturing closed-end fund who really needed to know that they could execute. They had to get out of the business. They needed to know who they're dealing with were serious. We found that we had the potential to acquire an underperforming asset that we knew could be managed more proactively with substantially improvement in performance. Although the Berlin market had not seen much rental rate growth in over a decade, Berlin was in fact the highest growing local economy of the major cities within Germany. In our view, was a market about to take off thanks in part to its appeal to the technology and media industries and its appeal to the millennial cohort. As a result, over the 12 months, actually a little less than that since we've owned it, the market vacancy in this market has hit a 10-year low, causing stagnant rental rates to move upward for the first time in a decade. We've pushed occupancy from 54% at acquisition to 75% as of today, and we expect to get to 85 or 90% by the end of the year and full occupancy by the middle of next year. We've also reversed course on the prior owner's condo conversion plan. They basically were taking apartments, turning them into empty apartments so that they can sell them as condos. So we've reversed course on this because we found the economics of doing that actually negative. And they're spending about 3,000 euros per door fixing the apartments up and expect to have them all rented and stabilized also by next year. We're currently planning a retail redevelopment to enhance the appeal of this project's retail offering and are working on hotel and leisure improvements as well. In this investment, Brookfield Property Partners is the managing general partner and owns a 25% equity investment alongside of Brookfield's institutional investor clients. This investment looks to be a huge success for us and underscores the merits of our placemaking strategy and the power of our investments that we have made in our platforms and how they help us create value. Within the core office group, we've also been very active on the development front. And, you know, just to maybe as a refresher, we developed to earn premium risk-adjusted returns and to upgrade our portfolio in strategic markets. Mostly what we do as we launch new developments in these markets is recycle capital out of older assets that we own there. We spend a considerable amount of time during cyclical downturns assembling, planning, gaining approval, and positioning our developments to be a first mover, to be ahead of the development herd. We don't at all consider ourselves speculative office developers and seek to reduce the inherent risk in development by securing anchor tenant leases prior to launching full-scale development of around 40 to 50% that helps protect us on the revenue side. We enter into guaranteed maximum price contracts with well-financed contractors to protect us on the cost side. We arrange construction financing with multiple extensions in case at the end of construction and stabilization, credit markets are in a bad way. We seek also to take money off the table as soon as value has been created by bringing in early joint venture partners. Our capital exposed to development, we limit to below 10% of our balance sheet. And we also focus on markets where we're currently invested, markets that we understand and that are also high growth. So in total, we have 8 active office development projects comprising 7.3 million square feet. We've begun early works on another million square foot project. We are 56% leased on average with a very fulsome pipeline and expect by the end of the year to improve that number. We are targeting a 7% average yield on cost, and the collection of these 8 projects should increase NOI by over $300 million a year. Now, you know, just a couple of comments I'd make on this slide. You know, first of all, these projects are great projects. They're in really strong markets. They're well located. They're incredibly valuable. The buildings delivered over the next 18 months are, you know, pretty fully leased. With a solid pipeline of activity to lease the remaining part. And we also, as you can see from the bottom of this slide, have great names in our anchor tenants for these projects. The projects, you know, we have, as they come online, we have a growing income stream sort of built in in place. And at today's cap rates, we expect that these projects will add somewhere around $7 billion in value to the company. So very, very substantial. And we think we're doing it on a very low-risk basis. We also have a very robust development pipeline. So when conditions are right, we've secured anchor tenant leases, we'll be able to advance another 8 million sq ft of development within our office portfolio. So moving on to maybe some of the risks or turbulence that we're seeing within our portfolio. You know, one thing that is often talked about is Brexit and its impact on our holdings in this market. In our view, the U.K. will always be a very important international center of finance and commerce. You know, I can tell you just from the perspective of a CEO in the U.K. who was on the phone with today, and I was asking about the impact of Brexit on his business, and he said to me, "Are you kidding me? We're very optimistic with the U.S. presidential election coming up. When you get Donald Trump as a president, we think we're gonna benefit quite well." So, they're clearly the glass is more than half full in London. You know, for us, I think our house view is that in the short term, there's certainly some uncertainty. In the long term, London will always be a very important center of commerce and finance, as I said. But in the meantime, we're pretty, you know, we're pretty well insulated from the short-term turbulence within our office portfolio. 98% of our space is leased to high credit quality tenants. We have an average lease term of 12 years or more. Our current developments are 55% pre-leased. We've got one active discussion going on that would meaningfully increase that number. We've got construction financing in place and not a lot of money exposed to the British pound. So, you know, I think we're in good shape, but certainly a little bit of uncertainty around Brexit. You know, the other area of exposure for us, I'd say, is energy sector markets. You know, we've talked a lot over the years about our activities in these markets. We've, you know, the one way, you know, we know that because of energy and the volatility in that commodity, that it's a market more at cyclical risk. So the way we operate our business is to take money off the table, constantly recycle our equity out of the market. In the case of Calgary, we've done that a couple of times. We've got long, very long-term leases in place, on average, 7.4 years, high-quality tenants. We have very little development going on that's not pre-leased. We have actually none that it's not substantially pre-leased, and a limited amount of our money exposed to this market. So, you know, so a little bit of turbulence in these markets, but I think, you know, the way we're positioned, the way we manage our portfolio, we'll do just fine. And, you know, in the meantime, you know, I'd say our business has been built through lots of transactions that have capitalized on uncertainties in markets. So, you know, we're certainly in all of our markets looking for opportunities where there's distress or uncertainty, but also, as in the case of Potsdamer Platz, looking for properties which on the surface people may not appreciate, that they're mispriced and that there's a way to take our platform and add value through operational improvements. So that's the update on our office business. And if there's any questions at the end, we'd be happy to take them. Thank you. Lowell.
Thanks, Ric. Good afternoon, everyone. So what I thought I'd do is spend the next several minutes taking you through an overview of our multifamily business generally, but also with a specific focus on our recent but growing urban strategy. We expect the multifamily sector to be a major avenue of growth for Brookfield, with the potential to become a core, permanent, and significant business. Our multifamily activities started with a focus on value-add suburban Class B assets, which is now being augmented with our focus on high-quality infill urban markets. In today's environment, where existing high-quality urban multifamily asset prices exceed the cost at which we can develop these assets, we are focused on a build-to-core model, often leveraging land parcels which we already own through our office portfolio. And at the right time and for the right opportunities, we expect acquisitions of existing assets will become a future avenue of growth. The following timeline provides a brief background of our multifamily activities. As is generally the case with Brookfield, That activity began with the acquisition of a highly experienced operating platform, in this case, Fairfield Residential, which we bought in 2010. With the Fairfield platform came 30 years of multifamily experience, over 1,500 employees, operations in 40 markets across the country, and expertise in both ground-up development and acquisitions. With this expertise in hand, we began investing, mainly through value-add and opportunistic strategies, growing our portfolio to approximately 40,000 units by the end of 2015. As we have begun to complete our business plans for the earlier investments, we have begun to prune the portfolio with very strong results, realizing returns well in excess of 20% IRRs on investments that we made between 2010 and 2013. Today, our portfolio stands at approximately 130 properties, exhibiting 94% occupancy, and a full-scale vertically integrated operating platform with approximately 1,600 dedicated multifamily employees. Our assets are highly concentrated in the coastal markets and Sunbelt, where we see higher incomes and better job growth. Our knowledge and operations in these markets are very deep, and our experience through our operating platform has spanned multiple cycles in these markets. So why are we adding our recent focus to urban multifamily? Statistics and science both show us the continuing trend of urban migration. Younger people are staying in cities longer than in the past. Baby boomers are returning to cities as their children move out of their homes. We expect to see cities continue to increasingly become desirable places for people of all ages to live, and we have had a front row seat to see this through our boots on the ground and our CBD-focused office platform. As we think about which sectors should be the core permanent platforms for Brookfield, multifamily clearly stands out, exhibiting over the long term one of the highest returns of all major sectors with significantly less volatility. The non-discretionary nature of housing leads to the sector's very attractive risk-return profile. Apartments have seen 6 years of healthy rent increases with continued, albeit slower, growth expected. While we expect growth deceleration in 2017 as the market absorbs the current supply deliveries, we expect that supply will slow down as we have seen construction lenders begin to pull back and equity allocated to new development has begun to dwindle. We believe that will both lead to an acceleration of growth in 2018 and 2019, as well as provide attractive opportunities for us as others pull back. On the occupancy side, multifamily exhibits strong and consistent occupancy rates across cycles. The short-term nature of leases provides operators the flexibility to adjust rates to match demand as needed to maintain healthy occupancy rates and manage profitability. The declining home ownership rate in the U.S. has created a tailwind of strong rental demand. We expect that demand will be there to absorb the current supply deliveries while keeping industry occupancy at or near peak. Going forward, however, we believe this factor is mostly played out, and the home ownership rate should stabilize and even begin to grow slightly. Anecdotally, we are beginning to see this in Brookfield's home building business as demand for new home sales has started to exhibit healthy growth. Our target markets for our urban strategy include both the traditional coastal markets, New York City, Boston, Washington, D.C., L.A., San Francisco, and Seattle, but also include certain dynamic growing markets that exhibit strong diversified economies, good quality of life, healthy job growth, and growing populations. Examples of these markets would include Portland, Dallas, Atlanta, and Miami. Through our efforts to date in our urban strategy, we have active development projects underway in New York City, Southern California, and London. These projects are on schedule to be delivered over 2018 and 2019, which we think will be a favorable time for delivery, and at healthy yields, which will create significant value as compared to current cap rates in these markets. Of note, 3 Manhattan West, our 62-story high-rise tower in Manhattan, has topped out, and we expect to start delivering units next year. Our future development pipeline continues to grow with attractive opportunities within our target markets and at higher yields with significant value creation potential. In addition to the properties listed here, we have a further pipeline of potential projects that are currently being evaluated. That covers my topic on multifamily, and I'll hand it over to Ashley on retail.
Thank you. Thanks, Lowell. So what you're going to see as I go through our core retail portfolio is a lot of similarities that Rick went through on our office core office portfolio, and indeed with a lot of the other businesses over the last day or so that you've heard about. There's a tremendous amount of consistency in terms of these assets. So our core retail portfolio is really one of the best performing Class A mall portfolios in the country, characterized by very high sales volumes and very strong foot traffic, shopper foot traffic. And again, as mentioned in many other presentations, it produces a very high quality and stable level of cash flow over the long term. The malls are through our interest in general growth properties. We own and invested in 100 of the top 500 malls in the country. And the way we like to describe these to give people a better sense of these assets is they're generally irreplaceable in nature. When you think about the barriers to entry that exist today for scale retail development in the country, namely building and accessing land in what are generally built up or infill locations and the entitlements that go with that, what we see with our portfolio when you think of Ala Moana in Honolulu, or the Miami Design District down in Florida, is these are generally assets that are very difficult to replicate today in the country. We have sales levels in our malls that are now pushing up towards $600 a square foot, which is quite high. Our shoppers in our malls generally visit more than twice a month and generally have incomes that are exceeding about $80,000 in terms of household incomes. So again, a very strong portfolio. In terms of the scale of our operation, we have about $9 billion of capital invested in our core retail platform. It's 125 million square feet spread across 128 properties. Again, part of the stability is the 95% occupancy that we have today. And this is generally kept within a very narrow band in the mid-90s. So it is a very stable occupancy portfolio. And again, our sales at 583, pushing up towards $600 a foot, which is a very strong sales volume. And this is about just over 20% higher than our sales level 5 years ago. So we continue to see growth in our sales levels. One of the main topics we hear about, questions we get, and I'm sure everyone in this room has read articles about it, is the perceived pressure that e-commerce is putting on bricks and mortar retail and what this means in terms of a decline for bricks and mortar. What we are seeing in our businesses and what the body of evidence is now presenting to us as e-commerce strategies have evolved and retailers have evolved is that the data coming out from the last few years as this evolution of e-commerce has occurred actually don't support the decline of bricks and mortar. And what you're actually seeing is very much the reverse, that bricks and mortar and are actually assisting with e-commerce sales growth for the retailers. So we actually view this more as an evolution of our bricks and mortar. There's definitely a change going on, and our approach to our operations and our assets has shifted to meet this. But I think there's a few important points that I'll just make here in terms of this perceived decline. Today, 85 to 90% of retail activity still occurs in bricks and mortar. So it's a tremendous amount of activity that people are actually still going to retail stores for. I think another interesting point to keep in mind is that 7 of the 10 e-commerce, top e-commerce retailers in the US by revenue are actually traditional retailers that had added an e-commerce segment to their business. Many of them actually tenants of ours, including Macy's, Walmart, Best Buy. These are all traditional retailers that have enhanced their business, increased their sales through the addition of e-commerce. And then one final point on that, online purchases, 2/3 of consumers that make an online purchase will visit a physical store related to that purchase either before or after they make that purchase. So again, the consumers are actually showing their preference for visiting physical stores. So I think there is a polling slide coming up here related to shopping. Shopping trends, I guess, and generations. So which generation has the highest propensity to shop in a mall at least once every 3 months? Millennials, Generation Xers, Baby Boomers, or the Silents? Oh. Let's give it another second here. All right, so we have Generation Xers leading the charge here, almost 50% response. All right, we can go back to the slides now. It's actually the millennials. Millennials have the highest propensity to visit physical stores of all four of those generations. For those who didn't get it, intuitively, I understand why, because the millennials grew up with online retail, and they are probably, without a doubt, the most tech-savvy generation out there. But again, they are showing their propensity to visit physical stores. Not only that, but amongst all of these generations, you are seeing a shift in how they spend their disposable income as it relates to retail. And what you're finding is now more than 50%, again, this is across all those generations, not just millennials, more than 50% of their disposable income is now going to experiences as opposed to goods or scientifically stuff. Which again is a main part of when we talk about the evolution of our retail, the main part of our evolution is to meet that demand for experiences. And that's this term that I'm sure all of you have heard, experiential retail. In its simplest forms, it's things like entertainment, dining options, restaurants, those kind of experiences that you are now, if you go to your local mall, I'm sure in many places, especially in the New York City area, you're going to see many more of those entertainment-related experiential tenants. I think the other important thing that comes out of this is that retailers see this. Retailers understand that, again, all these generations, all their consumers still like to go to physical stores. And this is even the case for pure-play e-commerce. And what you're seeing now is this shift to an omni-channel approach, which, again, is a term I'm sure you've all heard at some point. But now that there's a larger body of data available, what they're finding is that when you have physical stores in combination with e-commerce, not only do you get the added efficiencies of fulfillment and returns, but your overall sales levels go up. You get additional, obviously, incremental sales in your physical stores. But not only that, when you have the physical stores, your e-commerce sales tend to increase. And what they are leaning towards is because of this experiential retail, because of the branding of a store, because of the impact a physical store has on a shopper, that bricks and mortar retail really are going to continue to be the main retail venue to push goods and push brands out to the consumer. So how are we doing as we evolve our malls? Well, I think the answer is pretty well, and I think the metrics on our portfolio performance will show that. Again, we have very stable occupancy sitting right now at 95%. Again, very narrow band of variation. That variation you do see, for the most part, is related to space coming on and offline as we redevelop and change the structure of our assets. So at the end of the day, what you're going to see is a very stable long-term occupancy. In addition, our foot traffic is also stable. And with malls, it's always a key driver to know how many people are actually walking through your hallways. We, about 5 years ago, had about 400, just over 400 million annual visits, 415 call it. Today, we're at 450 million. So we are still seeing stable and increasing foot traffic to our physical real estate. Again, as mentioned, tenant sales, we continue to see increases 3% over the last trailing 12 months. And again, this is about 23% higher than we were 5 years ago. And to go along with this and the stable occupancy and the higher foot traffic, we are still seeing very healthy leasing spreads. For leases commencing this year and next year, we have a 26% spread on the rates that we're doing on those new leases. If you take that performance of our malls and you segment it out into what I'll call quality segments based on sales per square foot. What we generally look at a slide like this and take away from it is that two-thirds of our core retail income is coming from the top 40% of the malls from a performance perspective. And what this means to us is really, really two things. One, we already have a relatively stable portfolio with relatively strong income in place. But when you segment it down, you see that the majority of the income is actually coming from the most resilient of our assets. I think the second thing we take out of this is generally our higher growth assets are in the top performing segments here. So as that income grows, you will see the proportion towards the stronger resilient assets continue to increase. So I think the other thing that probably everyone in this room has heard about is, as it relates to retail malls, is obviously the struggles that the anchor department stores have had. And there's no doubt they are struggling to adapt their business models. I think what gets lost in the discussion when this is raised as it relates to owners, especially owners of portfolios such as ours that I've been going through here, is that this is actually a remarkable opportunity when taken in the context of the evolution, the experiential retail that I've been talking about. We actually need the physical space to put in the movie theater, the fitness, the large format, grocery store, the restaurant pavilion, all those things need physical space. And it's very difficult to actually try and shoehorn them into existing inline space in malls. These vacant anchor boxes provide us with that physical real estate in a more cost-effective manner. In addition, generally, the anchor stores are not high revenue producing. And when you replace them with these higher revenue producing, higher foot traffic tenants, there's obviously a bottom line benefit. There's also a benefit to the balance of the mall. Again, at GGP, they've done about 82 of these redevelopments. About $1.4 billion has been put into these. And again, because of the higher production that comes out, we're seeing an 11% return on that investment. So again, another consistent theme that we're seeing, again, not just across our real estate sectors, but across all of the Brookfield businesses, is a recycling of capital. And the malls are no exception. Peak valuations right now in the mall sector are one opportunity for us to raise equity. And you can see we've raised about $420 million to date this year, the majority of that coming from a partial sell down of the interest in Fashion Show Mall in Las Vegas. Again, one of the better malls in the country at a sub-4 cap rate. This is consistent with last year, where a similar strategy was executed as it relates to Ala Moana in Honolulu with a partial sale of an interest there, raising in total roughly about the same, maybe a little bit more in terms of net proceeds last year. Again, what we're seeing with these sales is that the valuations today, you can never actually pick the right spot, but they are definitely peak or near peak valuations. We're taking this cash and we're, again, reinvesting it within the business. The redevelopment and development opportunities, again, all related to the anchor stores, all related to the experiential retail change and the change in consumer demands and retailer demands, is allowing us to take this 4% cap net proceeds, turn around and invest it into redevelopments in our portfolio that are going to yield for us roughly 8 to 10% yields. And this is based on developments that have been completed in the recent past by the team at General Growth. So again, we're still doing some work on Ala Moana in terms of some repositioning of a Nordstrom box. Really the main chunk of the 300 or so million in terms of development costs there are the expansion in Staten Island Mall. 400,000 square foot expansion, movie theater, restaurants, all the stuff that consumers and retailers are demanding. And then, of course, our ground up development in Southern Connecticut, the Sono Collection, which is just a tremendous location in terms of its New York City area, Southern Connecticut, which is generally under retailed and again anchored by Bloomingdale's and a Nordstrom. So I think that's going to be a great development for us. The last thing I will do while I'm up here is just very quickly take you through the incremental investment we made to privatize Rouse Properties, the BMall company. And really the point we want to make about this is that not all BMalls are created equal. We think there's, in the negative sound bites that have been out there about BMalls, we think there's probably about two categories that have been unfairly lumped into this conversation, and I'll get to those in a second. But Rouse Properties, 24 million square feet across 35 malls in the U.S. We're 91% occupied. Again, intuitively, if you take the sound bites at face value, you might not expect a BMall company to be 91% occupied, but again, not all created equal. The portfolio is across the country, as mentioned. There's an appealing concentration here on the West Coast that you can see. But really, these malls, for the most part, fall into two categories that I mentioned earlier. The first, only game in town malls. So these tend to be smaller markets, but they also tend to be the only mall available to consumers and retailers to be in that market. So they have very limited competition. And I think a number of the Rouse malls fall into this category, and they produce very, very stable results, stable cash flows, because not a whole lot is changing in these markets. I think the other category that gets overlooked a little bit in the discussion around B malls is B malls that, by virtue of their location, whether it be demographics or population, job growth, all those things have caught up with the locations of some of these B malls. And if you think about it, malls sit on 10, 12, 15, 20 acres in some cases. They have now become what are fundamentally great retail locations. And what it takes is someone to understand how to convert, repurpose, reuse that mall. And you can, in some cases, take B malls and turn them into A malls simply by virtue of taking advantage of the location that you're sitting in. Again, with Rouse, we've identified some non-core sales, about $200 million. These are either non-core assets or assets where the repositioning is complete. We're going to take that value creation, monetize it, and again, recycle this into new opportunities that we're seeing, both in organic redevelopments within the portfolio as well as new acquisitions. Again, we have about 17 redevelopment projects going on within Rouse now. Most of them have commenced. There are a couple in the early stages. Take about $155 million to complete those, and we're expecting 9 to 11% yield, so not dissimilar to our other mall redevelopments. In terms of acquisitions, again, we're seeing quite a few compelling opportunities in the B mall space, where these malls have the opportunity to be reinvented, to be repositioned into something else. And again, we have to be very targeted and selective in how we identify those opportunities. Our view is you need to be where the population is, you need to be where the job growth is. It's not, it's perhaps intuitive to say that, but you have to be very, very targeted that you don't jump out of those boundaries. And so we're aiming up and down the coast, and probably a little bit down into job growth areas in Texas in order to identify these. Now, one last thing I will just point out is that Lowell had a slide up here earlier with his map of targets for the multifamily growth. And they're almost an identical overlay. And that just points to one last thing I'd like to note is that many of these assets have densification opportunities. When you have that much land, in some cases in infill locations, there's a big opportunity to bring other uses onto those sites. And when you think about our competitive advantage, we have the ability to reach into the businesses that operate beside us, the multifamily business as an example, bring in that expertise and that skill set and leverage that to make sure, one, we identify the right opportunities, and two, we're able to execute them on and create the value that we're looking to create. And with that, I will turn it back over to Brian.
Thanks, Ashley. So as I mentioned earlier, about 20% of our capital is invested in our more opportunistic strategies, which are really generally conducted through our participation in Brookfield-sponsored funds. These assets are generally high quality, but have a significant amount of operational upside. And that's really what we're looking for, is opportunities to utilize some of these operating platforms that you've heard about to buy undermanaged, underinvested in assets, and then drive higher returns through them. Our investment approach is, and generally we're seeking countercyclical investments in markets or sectors or geographies that are out of favor. They're often made through more complicated, multifaceted transactions, take privates, debt restructurings, or in markets where capital is scarce, because people have a real or perceived concern about the risks there that we think we're better able to underwrite. We utilize our entire network to identify these opportunities. So although we have 15,000 people working in our core real estate business, many of them are our best business development people out there identifying opportunities. They're speaking to tenants, other owners, other investors in the markets. And a lot of our ideas are generated up through that. And we utilize them both to help us underwrite, identify the opportunities, first of all, underwrite them, and ultimately manage them with a great deal of efficiency. So, I'm going to jump to one more polling question this time, rather than just letting you guess, and I'm much less stressed about it because now there's only five possible answers on this poll. Before I talk a bit about some of the sectors that we've been investing in, just by way of a quick poll of the audience, which of these five sectors do you think has had the highest growth rate over the last 20 years? And so I'm suspicious now. This is either a case of we've been leading the witness over the last 2 days, because I think we've now mentioned self-storage about three times at three different spots, or a very astute audience. I'm going to go with the latter. It's right. I mean, self-storage NOI growth over the past 20 years has been 4.3%. By contrast, industrial was just under 2%, retail was about 3%, office was about 3%, and as was multifamily. So, this has been, maybe we can go back to the slides, an area that's been a lot of focus for us as we start to think about new markets or new sectors that we'd like to be in. Self-storage is one of them. Let me just pause while the slides come up. Right. Self-storage has been a sector that we've been targeting for a while because of that. And really, Lowell and Ashley touched on it, but we try to learn from all of our businesses as to where we think the opportunities are. And obviously one of the big themes that we're seeing today is urbanization. People are living in smaller residential units in more urban locations, which obviously is impacting our decisions around where we're investing in multifamily. It's impacting how we're investing in retail. But it's also a significant driver of why this particular sector has had such tremendous growth over the last 20 years, really, is as that urbanization has happened, there's been a big increase in the demand for this type of real estate. And for any of you who have actually rented a self-storage unit, although these are 30-day leases, generally, once you rent them, you rent it for a very long, long time. And so as a result of that, we have relatively sticky tenants. The CapEx is pretty minimal. And so as a result, this business generates very high levels of cash on cash yield. So what you have is a sector that's growing above average, generating a lot of cash flow, and is generally pretty predictable in its growth. All of the characteristics that we're generally looking for when we're investing in real estate. The challenge or the opportunity for us in self-storage is this is a highly fragmented industry. The top 100 owners of self-storage in the United States own less than 10% of the total square footage, making it a challenging sector for a lot of institutional investors to invest in. So specifically what we did earlier this year was we closed on the acquisition of the largest privately held self-storage business, which is sort of seventh overall, really through a relationship that we had. So this was not through an auction. We negotiated directly with them. We were able to buy the entire business, including the management team, which has over 20 years of experience in the sector. And we now have depth of experience in the sector. Importantly, we have people on the ground to own and manage these assets for us and identify new acquisition opportunities. And so although we closed on the initial transaction at the start of the year, through subsequent follow-on investments that we've made, additional portfolios, single assets, et cetera, we've already doubled the size of that business. Our plan is to grow this into a significant scale self-storage business, buying assets one, two, three at a time, taking out cost synergies and driving growth through that, ultimately building it into a business that's of investable scale for institutional investors who have a lower cost of capital. And so we think there's a real arbitrage opportunity right now in this particular sector, and we've got a team behind this that we think is going to help us drive that. So it's a very exciting opportunity. We think our returns on this are going to be well north of 20% for what is a pretty stable, predictable business in the most predictable, stable market in the world today. And so this is really why we are, these are the type of opportunities we're looking for on the opportunistic side. Another area where we spend a significant amount of our time on in our opportunistic is in places like Brazil or like India, where we have a significant operating presence. We think we have a good handle on what's happening on the ground. And so earlier this year, we were able to acquire a portfolio of seven very high quality Class A office buildings in the highest rent districts in Sao Paulo and Rio. Because there is a lack of capital down there and really a challenging economic environment, we're able to buy this portfolio, which are really seven of the top 15 office buildings in the entire country, at a 40% discount to the cost to build them within the last 3 years. So all of these assets are either brand new or redeveloped within the past 3 years. Our purchase price is a 40% discount to what somebody else spent to do that. Part of what created the opportunity is there's some vacancy in a couple of the more recently completed buildings, but we think with our cost basis, we're really going to be able to undercut any of our competitors in the market with respect to the leases that we need. And so, really what we've created here is an opportunity to buy assets that if these were in New York or in London would generate high single digit returns at best. We think these will be 20% plus returns on exactly the kind of assets that, that we own elsewhere in the world. So in total today, we have about $4 billion of capital invested in our various opportunistic strategies, ranging from, what are truly opportunistic, like the ones that I just described, to more value add or debt strategies that are targeting mid-teens returns. The real advantage of this is that $4 billion of capital that we have invested actually gives us an exposure to over $30 billion of assets around the world because we're partnering with institutional investors. Generally, you saw from the previous slide, we have about 20 to 25% of the equity in these investments. It gives us a very broad exposure to a lot of different sectors around the world for a relatively small capital commitment. And we're continuing to expand. So in addition to some of the businesses I showed you on the earlier one, we're moving into new sectors. Manufactured housing is a good example of that. We are expanding into some new markets, including a 5.5 million square foot mixed use complex, very similar to the one that Rick described earlier in Berlin. This particular one's in Seoul, South Korea. And we are continuing to expand some of the platforms that we've previously invested in. For example, in India, where we're about to close on a 4 million square foot portfolio of very high quality office buildings in Mumbai. It will make us the largest office landlord in that country. So this is a very active part of our business on the new acquisition side. That being said, while we think these are relatively low risk ways of investing in real estate because what we're buying are assets that have significant operational upside. We're generally buying them at big discounts to replacement costs. They don't come without risk. And so as a result of that, our core office and core retail and core multifamily businesses will always be the engine of the business. They will generate the long-term stable cash flows. And we're really planning to limit this opportunistic investing to 25% of our balance sheet to really sort of drive incremental returns. The good news is over the last couple of years, we've been recycling capital out of our core operations and deploying it into this new space. But the business really, or this investment strategy really becomes self-funding. Because these are shorter duration investments, the capital is constantly coming back as these investments are realized and it provides us with more capital to invest into the next strategy. So we expect by 2020, we will have about $4 billion of cash out of that $4 billion that's invested today returned to us that will be available to us to redeploy into these strategies. And so the strategy really becomes self-funding, really from this point forward. So with that as a quick overview on the opportunistic portion of the balance sheet, Brian was going to give an overview on the overall business again.
Thank you, Brian. There's just two things that I really wanted to cover over the next 10 to 15 minutes. If I am sniffling up here tonight, it's not because I'm trying to mimic Donald Trump from the first presidential debate. It's because I happen to get a little bit of a cold last night. Really, the two things are positioning our balance sheet and how that is putting us in the right position to continue to grow what we deem to be very stable cash flows. I'd say both of these topics are very consistent with what we talked to you last year when at the same Investor Day event. And not surprisingly, it's very consistent with, you know, the topics that the other Brookfield platforms have talked to you about, because our strategies are very, very similar. I think our perspective this time, though, is really to highlight the incremental changes that we have been making to our balance sheet that we've been relentless in pursuing, and really since we launched in 2013 to position us really for growth that we expect to see over the next 5 years. I'd say going back to 2013, and I apologize if this is a little bit repetitive to what you have heard, but it is deliberate. Going back to 2013 when we launched BPY, the objective was to aggregate all of Brookfield's real estate assets into a single vehicle, and it's really a flagship public vehicle. You know, on launch, there were certain things about BPY that weren't perfect. They weren't ideal. I'd say we had too much capital that was invested in public securities, as Brian had mentioned. You know, we had a significant amount of capital invested in a passive manner in a core office portfolio in the UK, which, you know, Rick had talked about. I don't think we had the right balance at the time between core and opportunistic capital in order to support the yield and return targets that we were targeting. And we didn't have as much financial flexibility with our balance sheet on launch that we would have liked to have had without relying on Brookfield's support. And so I'd say each year we really set out to address this, and piece by piece we reshaped our balance sheet. You know, in 2014, you know, the focus was on changing the composition of our core platforms. You know, really, that's the first column that you see there. We acquired all of Brookfield office properties, and we converted our passive interest in the Canary Wharf estate into a controlling interest. In 2015, you know, we shifted our focus really to raising capital, and not just raising capital, but redeploying capital and reallocating it from our core office platform that we invested in 2014 and into, you know, our development initiatives, and also to fund the commitments we made to a number of the real estate funds that had launched during that period. You know, in 2016, where we are today, we have continued to shift our focus a little bit, this time really to liquidity. You know, Brian talked about it a little bit in his objectives, but, you know, on that note, we set out to seek a, you know, a investment grade credit rating, which we were able to accomplish by getting a BBB rating. We also put in place a new $2.5 billion bank credit facility with, you know, 16 globally diverse institutions, you know, many of which are represented here today, and we thank you for that support. And we continue to recycle capital out of core assets and high demand markets, which Rick and Ashley had talked about. And really what that did was that positioned, you know, our balance sheet to where you see it today. We increased the capital invested in our development pipeline from $1 billion to $3.5 billion. We increased the amount of capital that we have in our opportunistic strategy from $1.2 billion to $4.2 billion. We increased our equity from $14 billion to $24 billion as we issued $5 billion of perpetual capital to fund this growth in our core portfolios. And I think most importantly, we began to create a track record of earnings and growth. You know, during this period from launch to today, we've generated $2.6 billion in company FFO, and we've generated $8 billion in net income. You know, through all of this growth, you know, we feel we have been very disciplined in sourcing the most effective, cost-effective capital. You know, in the case of acquiring BPO, we issued $3.5 billion of common units to complete that transaction. You know, based on the performance to date, we have had a 16% on return on that capital. Now, over the long term, we're always targeting 12 to 15%, so we've been able to achieve that return to date. For Canary Wharf, we issued $1.8 billion of a mandatorily convertible preferred share with a conversion price equal to the net asset value of our units at that time. You know, based on the performance of that investment to date, you know, we've had a 12% return on that capital. You know, since those two transactions, we focused on surfacing capital from our well-leased, well-located assets in major markets. And in 2015 and 16 alone, we executed on over 20 transactions, selling interests in 45 properties at very attractive cap rates, and in most cases above our IFRS values, which is indicative of the strong demand in those markets. And in 2017, we expect to extract capital from our fund investments as our first generation funds begin to enter the realization phase of their life cycle, which, you know, Brian showed you on a previous slide. This is going to accumulate $4 billion of capital. It's going to be available to us to reinvest into the next generation of funds. It's also going to be available to us to redeploy back into our core portfolios as we expand those as well. You know, during this time, we advanced our development pipeline. You know, we completed a number of projects, which, you know, we really haven't talked about in this presentation. Bay Adelaide Centre East, anchored by Deloitte & Touche as a tenant. It's a $350 million project, is complete now. It's expected to generate $25 million of stabilized NOI. It's 76% leased, and that's 8 months in advance of the stabilization period that we underwrote. Brookfield Place, Perth, we completed the second phase of that development. It was a $260 million development, expected to generate $21 million of stabilized NOI. It's 65% leased, 11 months in advance of stabilization. In addition, there's been a number of redevelopment projects that we've advanced and completed. Brookfield Place Retail, as Rick talked about, we effectively reinvented the retail space in this complex, and we expect to generate $30 million of NOI off of that project, which is an 11% yield on cost, very similar with the projects that we're targeting in both of our retail platforms. At 5 Manhattan West, where we repositioned what was an unsightly office building in New York and turned it into a cool office building in New York. And we expect to generate $34 million of incremental NOI, which is actually an 18% yield on cost. And I'd say despite investing more capital, we continue to reduce the risk. We've advanced construction, we've moved forward timelines, and I think most importantly, we've sourced all the capital by securing construction facilities to be able to complete these developments through to the end. In addition to that, with 3 million square feet of leases executed, which contribute to a pre-leasing percentage of 56%, and an active development or an active pipeline of deals and discussions, we feel very comfortable with where those are at. You know, we've also increased the amount of capital, which Brian had talked about, into our opportunistic segment. It's at $4 billion. I think most importantly, that contributes to an increased earnings profile for our business. As you've seen, you know, in our most recent past two quarters, we're generating about a 9% FFO return on that capital invested in this opportunistic segment, which, you know, really complements our core office strategy as well. But I think equally as important is we've diversified our asset base through our investments into this sector. And not only from a sector perspective by adding self-storage, student housing, but we've also added new markets, including new markets in Europe, India, and China. I say all told, that really positions us and our balance sheet with the right capital to support what we have talked about over and over and over again, which is our simple goal of achieving a 12 to 15% return on capital in the long term. You know, Brian had a slide on this. This is really the numbers associated with that. We have to date 80% of our capital invested in core. you know, with experienced management teams, with quality assets that earn top rents in each market, maintain high occupancy, and achieve same-store growth. You add to that the ability to recycle capital out of those same assets and reinvest that capital back into the business to support new acquisitions at more opportunistic returns to support our development and redevelopment initiatives. You have the ability to generate 10 to 12% returns in this business. You know, with the remaining 20% of our capital, we have the ability to participate through the funds in a broad range of strategies and earn 18 to 20% on that capital. Put that all together, you get $24 billion of equity that has the earnings potential to earn annual FFO of $1.5 billion, and including capital appreciation, annual earnings power of between $2.8 and $3.5 billion. The FFO supports our distribution targets. You know, combine the capital appreciation, and that supports the return that we want to provide to each one of our shareholders. Now, in breaking down how we expect, you know, to achieve the $2 per unit in FFO by 2021, which really is, you know, is kind of the baseline earnings target that we have based on our current balance sheet, there have been three main drivers that we have talked about. I'd say the first one with same store growth. It's what we commonly refer to as blocking and tackling. Within same store growth, you know, through the first half of 2016 on a constant currency basis, as Rick showed in one of his slides, we had 12% growth in our core office portfolio. We had 3% growth in our retail portfolio. And we benefited mainly from the commencement of revenue recognition of leases in this complex. You know, these leases contributed, I think, about $85 million of incremental NOI in 2016. From 2017 onward, we expect to benefit a further, you know, $40 million just from this complex alone. And on average, we expect to see about $2.5 million of same-store growth for the balance of our core assets to reflect both the combination of lease-ups and also the mark-to-market of our rents as they roll. You know, if we're able to achieve this, we think FFO, you know, over the next 5 years will grow by $220 million. And really the simple math here is if you take both of our core office and our core retail portfolios, we have about $1.3 billion of same store and core office and about $700 million in core retail. You combine those together, you put a 2.5% growth target, which is something we've been able to achieve over the last 15 years on average. You take off that, you know, the carry costs associated with leasing capital, and you get your $220 million. Oops, sorry. The second is our active development pipeline. You know, we expect to stabilize each project that we listed in our active development pipeline, both from an office and multifamily perspective, during the next 5 years. We expect those to contribute an incremental $160 million. And I'd say that really the simple math there is there's about $6 billion of total capital being put into our assets, $4 billion in the office portfolio, $2 billion in the multifamily portfolio, at a yield on cost of between 6 and 7%. You take off that interest expense associated with 55% leverage on a stabilized basis. You take off of that the fact that we capitalize a return on the capital that we have invested in our development pipeline in our current earnings, and you get your $160 million over the next 5 years. And I'd say lastly is the reallocation of capital into higher yielding core assets or higher yielding opportunistic investments. We're constantly doing this. We do between 750 and a billion a year. Being able to capture a spread of 200 to 250 basis points puts us in a position where we'll be able to achieve $100 million in incremental FFO in 5 years. That brings us to our distribution. You know, that's really one of the key, you know, pillars in our investment thesis. And as we had talked about in the past, you know, we're focused on maintaining a distribution policy where we pay out 80% of our FFO to unit holders. If we're able to achieve the growth, which we think we will be able to, of FFO to $2 a share in 5 years, that means that we'll be able to pay out to our shareholders $1.60 per unit in distributions by 2021. This will represent a 7% annual growth rate since 2015, and it's in line with our target of achieving 5 to 8% annual distribution growth. You know, and I think a combination of this payout ratio, the diversity of our cash flows, it really provides very strong support to our current yield. You know, all of that means that we do have to manage risk. We talked about risk in the context of our assets and just our approach to investing. You know, we focus on long-term growth strategies. We focus on preserving the flexibility to invest in different markets and asset classes. We spend a lot of time and effort investing in our operating capabilities as a mitigant to risk. And we're also only building incrementally. We're never building transformationally. But I think in addition to that, we focus on sourcing the right capital and protecting that capital. And this is why we choose our conservative financing strategy. This is a slide that's been around for a number of years, but and is consistent across the Brookfield platforms. But we mainly finance at the asset level. And although this typically supports a higher level of debt, we feel that it offers protection to equity holders as it limits recourse. We target investment-grade loans at the asset level, which is a typical LTV ratio between 50 and 60%. We maintain a credit facility of sufficient size and term to provide short-term liquidity to bridge. We focus on the issuance of preferred shares despite the higher cost of capital to us because we benefit from perpetuity in that source of capital. And I think it's why we're committed to maintaining an investment-grade corporate credit rating that provides us the utmost flexibility to access all sources of capital as we look to fund our business going forward. You know, that brings us to leverage. You know, we've talked about our strategy in past conference calls, and it is to maintain a balance sheet that's 50% levered on a debt-to-capital basis over the long term. This does not mean to say that we will always be at 50% debt to capital, but it does mean that when we're above 50%, we will make sure that we identify initiatives that we will execute on during a period of time that makes sense in order to get us back down to that target level. You know, in the case of where we are today, we're focused very heavily on our corporate leverage, you know, and we have about $2 billion of repayments that we expect to be able to execute over the next 2 years, which if we're successful in doing brings us from 53% down to 50%. You know, the first are about $400 million of corporate bonds that we issued out of our office platform BPO in 2012 and 2013. We're looking to retire those. We have the repayment of our credit facility in BPO, and we also are looking to repay the credit facility that we just put in place in BPY, you know, by a further, you know, $600 to $1 billion. I think the majority of these proceeds from these initiatives will come from asset sales, as we will continue over the next 6 to 12 months in being active in recycling capital out of our core office assets. From an interest rate perspective, our goal is to, you know, maintain about a 25% floating rate exposure. We feel this is the right level, you know, taking into account the nature of our investing strategy, where, you know, at times we need to bridge the time it takes to raise long-term capital through our floating rate corporate revolver or our floating rate construction facilities, where at times we need to maintain the flexibility to be able to sell assets and maximize value at the asset level, particularly in our opportunistic strategy, and where at times we may be exposed to markets where the majority of available debt is shorter term and floating rate. But at times, like where we are today at 38%, you know, we actually feel reasonably comfortable with a higher level of floating rate exposure, but we appreciate that we are in a historically low interest rate environment. And although we think it's going to be lower for longer, we have a number of initiatives that will reduce this exposure going forward, you know, which we've listed, you know, on this slide. And I'd say lastly, from a risk perspective, and Rick alluded to this, you know, in talking about Brexit, you know, we feel comfortable with exposing about 20% of our overall equity to currencies other than the U.S. dollars. We prefer, of course, to naturally hedge our currency exposure with local currency debt. That typically brings us down to about 40% exposure. But we will actively manage a currency hedge book to further reduce this exposure, as we did, you know, with the pound in advance of Brexit. In that case, we layered on £1 billion of additional hedges in the month leading up to the vote to reduce our exposure to fluctuations in that currency from 12%, you know, which it was at the end of the first quarter, down to 5% of our total equity. Now, I'd say before I turn the podium back over to Brian to make some wrap-up comments and turn it over to Q&A, I did just want to end with three things. One, you know, we've worked hard to position our balance sheet to where we have advanced our development pipeline. We've achieved a balance between our core and opportunistic capital, and we've added diversity in asset classes and regional exposure. We are very focused on mitigating risks inherent invested in real estate on a global basis. And I'd say lastly, we are well positioned with where our balance sheet is today to be able to, achieve our 12 to 15% return targets going forward. So with that, I'll give it over to Brian.
So maybe just a couple of final comments, and then we'd be happy to take any questions. But you know, hopefully the presentation today gave you a bit of a sense for this. But you know, we do think this is a very unique real estate platform that we have built here. It's got global reach. We have these very significant operating platforms that allows us to source and manage and execute on investment strategies that very few other businesses in the world can do. Because of the size and scale of our balance sheet and our overall asset base, it allows us to take advantage of opportunities to develop in those markets where assets today are trading in excess of replacement cost. And so while on their own, this is a very significant development pipeline, I think as Brian walked you through, in the context of our balance sheet, it is very manageable. And these types of investments do generate very, very good returns. In addition to that, the other unique part of our platform is this opportunistic investing strategy and the ability for a publicly traded security with all of the liquidity benefits that come with that to have access to the types of investments that institutional investors, sovereign wealth funds, major pension funds, et cetera, normally are the only ones who have access to these private funds, and typically their capital is locked up for very long periods of time. We think this is a unique combination of the two businesses, and it allows us to earn what we think are returns that will be well in excess of what our typical peers would. Maybe just a final comment on share price and how all of this translates back to returns. I think we spent a bit of time earlier, and thank you for your helpful suggestions on how to close the gap between where we're trading today and what we think the underlying value of our real estate is. But this page really just takes what Brian outlined, which is, let's just assume for a second that we never close that gap. And with the growth in our business over the next 5 years, just holding the multiple that we trade at today, we think we generate a significant amount of return between the combination of this current yield, which is about 5% today, but hopefully, as we've demonstrated here, we can continue to grow that at 7 or 8% a year, and add on top of that the capital appreciation that really comes from just the natural growth in our core portfolios as the income grows there, but also these opportunistic strategies and reinvesting into higher returning ones. We think there are very few of our peers out there that can deliver that kind of return over such a long period of time. And so even without closing the gap, and I know for those of you who were here yesterday, this is an important part of our overall strategy, closing that gap between our trading price and what we think the underlying value of the business is. But even without that, we think that the growth in our earnings over the next 5 and even 10 years are going to continue to deliver very good returns. And it's an opportunity today where the stock is trading to invest in this at a discount. And should we be successful in closing that gap, those returns are on top of what you see here. So that kind of brings our formal presentation to a conclusion. We would be happy to take any questions. There are microphones floating around. If you'd just like to raise your hand, we'll try and get them to you. Okay, we'll start with Andrew.
Andrew Kresge, Credit Suisse. I guess the question is on the discount issue. If we went back almost 20 years ago at the BAM level, then Brascan, it was a very big discount to the NAV up until, let's say, 2003, 2005, in that kind of time frame, and then it started to narrow dramatically. So what's BPY's transformation from, you know, Brass Can to Brookfield Asset Management? What happens with BPY to really close that discount that you've got today?
Yeah, well, look, I think if let me make Brian answer this question, but look, at the end of the day on Brookfield Asset Management, I think what really helped to close that gap was a simplification of the story, you know, getting better understanding of what was happening. We've done a lot to simplify the Brookfield Asset Management story, including the spin out of these public affiliates, a lot more transparency into the values of the various components of the business. And I think prior to that, it had always sort of suffered from a you know, a complexity discount difficulty to values discount. It's largely what we're trying to do here. You know, we're really trying to make sure that people understand that, look, we could spend a lot of time talking about our investment in office buildings in India, for example, but it's a relatively small part of our balance sheet that provides some additional upside. The key components of our business really are this core office and core retail business, and that's easy to understand. I think most people here would agree with that. And those are really the key value drivers. And I think understanding the balance sheet and where capital is and where the growth is going to come from that is really a key part of the focus. So I think we're relentlessly focused on, you know, trying to make sure the story is easy to understand. You know, notwithstanding it is a very large scale business that you know, comes with a global platform like this one. Mark.
Thanks. Maybe I could ask two questions. Just first, it sounds like with Potsdamer, there's been some very successful lease up of that property or complex. Can you maybe give us some actual numbers on the going in returns you took when you bought the property, maybe what the current return is, and even with the development that the redevelopment you're still doing there, what the expected return is, maybe on an unlevered or an unlevered basis?
You know, maybe I'll answer it at a very high level, and if you have detailed follow-ups, I'll make Rick answer that for you. But this was a, on a going-in cap rate, I'm not sure it's terribly relevant, given that the office component of the complex was 50% leased. A very high portion of the residential apartments, as Rick mentioned, were sitting vacant. So it was you know, in the area of about a 5% return, but we're targeting 12 to 15% overall returns. It's not development heavy. There's some leasing capex and a little bit of repositioning to be done on the retail, but we're not tearing down and rebuilding buildings, et cetera. So we think for, you know, what is really an operational turnaround, it's a 12 to 15% return, pretty attractive for us.
Okay, and then clearly a key topic is closing the gap to NAV. As you mentioned, BAM had as a key number in its presentation yesterday. At the beginning of your presentation, you mentioned two actions that could or would be taken to close the gap. When you said actively exploring a conversion into a REIT, and also you mentioned stock buybacks. So for each one, maybe for REIT conversion, how likely is that to occur? And then as far as stock buybacks, it has been spoken about in the past, yet over the past couple of years hasn't been really something that's been extremely active, even though the gap's been wide. So how material could that be, or should we expect that to be? And just to that question also, is there another action that maybe you mentioned that I'm not repeating, or is there something else that's being considered also?
Yeah, look, on the REIT conversion, I think, we're at the early days of exploring it. We, as I mentioned earlier, we think there's a lot of benefits to the structure we've got. We didn't just happen into the Bermuda-based publicly traded partnership, and obviously all of our other flagship vehicles have the same structure. So we think there's a lot of merits in the current structure. However, some of the feedback we have been getting is index inclusion is important, particularly with fund flows in real estate, particularly going into ETFs, et cetera. And with our current structure, that is just not, it seems unlikely, despite our best lobbying efforts, that's going to change anytime soon. So we are spending some time on it. I'd say it's obviously a complex tax question as to the feasibility of converting and frankly, whether or not it would be that beneficial. So I don't want to put a handicap on it, but it's less than 50% at this stage. But I think it's something that over the next 6 months, we will either decide is a good idea and proceed with it or put it back on the shelf. As far as buybacks, you know, Brian kind of went through where our use of proceeds has been really over the last couple of years as we've been surfacing capital out of our more mature assets. A lot of it has gone into building out this development pipeline, new investments in our opportunistic strategies, and most notably paying down the BPO acquisition facility. Now that that's largely out of the way, you know, we think there is scope to ramp up the buybacks. And I think that's where we've been, you know, focusing, redeploying that capital on those other three areas. I think there is scope to increase it. Obviously, one of the issues I think you saw pop up, or one of the reasons what you saw pop up on there, was trading liquidity of the stock and reducing the float in some ways is counterproductive toward that. But, you know, as I said, we weigh buying back our stock against other investment opportunities and all the time. And it, you know, should it continue to trade at these kind of discounts, I think you'd see us more active.
Thank you. Mario Sarek from Scotiabank. Just coming back to the REIT conversion question, I recognize it's early days, but you know, do you see any implications of potentially converting to a REIT to the distribution, the attractive distribution per unit growth that you've highlighted in the documents here? And perhaps most importantly, the opportunistic mandate. So you've been increasing the weighting allocated to your opportunistic platform where you're generating really good returns. Are there any implications with your ability to continue to do that as a REIT going forward?
Yeah, again, it's early. I would say that you know, the biggest benefit, one of the biggest benefits we think from the structure that we have today is that we are able to recycle capital, so we can realize on investments, and typical REITs are distributing a much higher percentage of that, whereas we can retain a lot of it in the business and reinvest it. So it's one of the considerations, I think, when we're thinking about it is you know, the limitations that may put on that opportunistic investing. But, you know, as I said, it's a little early to say.
And then maybe second question, in terms of the complexity, you kind of referenced BAM's discount going away because it became a simpler story. Your better returns today are in the opportunistic platform. So you're generating really good returns there, and you're selling your core kind of office retail at very low going in cap rates. Core office and retail is generally easier to understand than self-storage or multifamily or some of those other assets. How do you strike the right balance between those two?
Well, look, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think we're looking at it today. We're 80-20 between the two. That opportunistic could become a slightly larger component of our overall strategy, but it's never going to be more than 25% of it, because although the returns do look very good today, it is, you know, as you mentioned, they're not without complexity or risk, et cetera. So we feel like we're in the sweet spot right now, and should a great opportunistic investment come along, or an opportunity to take some capital out of the core business at very, very low returns, we may do a little bit more, but we've largely made the adjustment that we were seeking to do back in 2013 when we first spun it. Over here.
Yes, Sheila McGrath from Evercore. Brian, I was wondering if you could help discuss which sectors we should expect to be on balance sheet. I guess it's office, retail, and now urban multifamily. Any chance industrial or self-storage will be on balance sheet, or will they remain an opportunistic?
You know, I think the... although they occasionally investments may end up on the balance sheet, I think the reality is core office and core retail are, there's a very large opportunity set out there. The assets are very large, you know, as are the corporate entities out there. And so I think those really, it's the three of those. Could industrial become a fourth one day? Yes, possibly. But self-storage would be very challenging to grow to the kind of scale that we're talking about here. And so we're really looking at that as an opportunity to consolidate in a highly fragmented industry, make good returns on it. But we will not have $50 billion of self-storage assets one day.
And then just on the multifamily that's on balance sheet, should we only expect that to be urban multifamily?
Yeah, I'll maybe we'll touch on it a little bit, but I would say that our investments to date in the suburban assets has been more, as I described, with self-storage. which is we thought these were opportunities to buy good quality assets in you know, sometimes secondary or suburban locations, fix them up, and ultimately sell them for a good return. When we think about urban multifamily and high-rise in some of the major cities, these are much more similar to the types of assets that we own on the office side, which is they're great for a very long time, and there's always opportunities to reposition them. And so that's really why we think the urban multifamily is what we'd seek to grow on the balance sheet. And in all likelihood, our suburban activities will continue, but in more of a transactional manner.
Okay. And one last question. If you could just update us or Rick on Manhattan West, 30% leased, just Manhattan supply, kind of your thoughts there.
Sure. I'll let Rick take that.
Yeah. So we have one office tower going up there, the Northeast Tower, one Manhattan West. It's currently a little over 30% leased. We have a lease out right now that should wrap up in the next few weeks, which would take us to about 40%. And a pretty good pipeline of activity right now. There are a number of new products coming online. There's lots of competition in that area from Related's project at Hudson Yards. They've had a strategy where they are effectively, selling a lot of their office density in order to get to what will likely be more profitable for them, the residential density. So that's been a little tough to compete with, but the good news is they're getting sort of to the end of the line as far as their office inventory goes. So, we're optimistic, expect to do very well. We've got a good product coming online. So.
Any other questions? Seeing none, well, thank you all for attending today's session. Suzanne was just going to come up and make a couple of final remarks, as this is the last presentation of the 2 days. So.